Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today we get to dive into one of those topics that I've been nerding about, I've been nerding about an adjacent field, which is regenerative business, I think. And today we might live more in regenerative economics land. Very welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you, Ralph Thom.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I will start you off in the way that I always do with these podcasts, which is part lazy, part actually a freedom for the guest to kind of define themselves as they see fit for the conversation. With the question, who are you, Ralf Thom?
I start to call myself a young veteran in the field of sustainability and regeneration. I started to be interested and then also excited about sustainability, reading the 1987 Brundtland Report. And that was just before I decided to study economics. And I come from Germany, and when you studied economics in Germany during that time, you studied microeconomics and macroeconomics. And I'm very thankful for that, because that has helped me very much to understand what I call the so-called micro-macro link of sustainability and regeneration as well. After my studies, wanting to be involved in different sets of organizations, I spent my first decade working at Siemens, big electrotechnical company, and in various functions. But I think for this discussion, the most important one was that I was charged to develop the first sustainability strategy for the company. That happened round about the years 1998 to 2002. During that time, I was talking to many people in the field, especially also from Siemens in different countries, different continents, and you've got so many different perspectives on what sustainability is that I was struggling to come up with a workable definition apart from what I knew from the Brundtland Report, but that needed to be translated into company jargon and into management strategy and into target setting and directives and policies and, of course, metrics. And during that time, I got in touch with a young project in the U.S. That called themselves the Global Reporting Initiative. And I connected with them, and I became involved in their aim to develop a sustainability reporting guidance, so to say, not just looking into the rear mirror of organizational doing, but also looking forward and to give people an idea of what the company stands for and how they see a sustainable path forward for them. And that was what I needed at that time. So I joined as a European industry expert. And then after delivering a first strategy at Siemens, the GRI decided to go to Amsterdam for the headquarter. They don't want it to be seen just as a US-based NGO. And I was asked to join them on the team. And so I was one of the first five team members of GRI when they settled in Amsterdam. And the work continued, and more generations of GRI guidelines were developed. And I was mainly, apart from my role as being COO and CFO and CIO of GRI, you always have these various hats on when you start a small organization, with the so-called principles section of the development of the guidelines. And that was really mind-blowing for me in a way that it was not just only about some sort of tick box exercise of indicators, but that there was also a bigger sort of surrounding of why are we doing this and how is it really connected to sustainability. And so from that moment onwards came my love for the sustainability context principle in GRI, which I am defending still today, because it has been watered down quite a lot. And that is also one of the reasons why we do the work that we do at R3.0. So I was with GRI until 2008. Then I had 5 years with Deloitte, because I also wanted to, you know, learn skills from that side and how people tick in the accounting and consulting business. And then in 2012, after the Rio Plus 20 conference, we decided to set up R3.0, which stands for Redesign for Resilience and Regeneration, which is quite a mouthful, but it also defines sort of the aim of that organization, which is a not-for-profit organization registered in Germany. And the aim was really to really work on what the outcome document of the Rio Plus 20 conference, the future we want, articulated. And that was that our government leaders had decided we wanted a regenerative and distributive economy, you would say, in today's terms. And we were looking around and wondering, so where are the organizations that are really dealing with this and who are designing this? Because it's not the future we want. It is a future that we design. So from that perspective, we didn't see a lot of activity. And we thought, let's jump into the cold water and just try to do our best to really articulate what sort of design is necessary. And that was the starting point of R3.0. And I can talk a lot more about that if you want. And we will most likely in this conversation. But that is where I'm currently working, the organization that I'm leading as a managing director, and which had a first, I would say, very successful decade. From 2012 to 2022, we're now in our 11th year. We've done 10 conferences, global conferences that were quite successful. And we're seeing a growing community around R3.0. And we're by far not where we need to be or where we want to be. But I think the growth that we've seen has been rather organic, very natural. And there are more and more people attracted to the sort of thinking that we developed over that first decade.
Thank you. Two things kind of spark my interest particularly, and one is the nerdier side of me, and the other is probably the more the more general curious person. But one of those things that I've been looking a lot about is like when you look at different fields and how they've evolved, a lot of the history and a lot of the conclusions that, or a lot of the situations that we find ourselves in now, or like that's guiding the conversations right now, seem to be pulling from different more or less visible threads of the past. So I'll go with a nerdy question first, which is sort of in the field of sustainability, the evolution or like the terminology or taxonomy or whatever you want to call it, like what has been the evolution of the principles of that field since you started in it?
And that's a good question, because the real question is, has there been evolution?
Yeah. Sure.
I think. And I look back at the time from the Brundtland Report and the Brundtland Report definition of sustainability, which just literally says, don't do anything in your generation that will reduce the possibilities of future generations to have the same opportunities like you had. Mm. And I'm just not seeing anywhere that we are actually working towards that. Mm. I think what we have seen is more and more of a watering down of the idea of sustainability. And I sometimes think it's like a comic version, or has become a comic version, that's not to laugh about. You know, it was, when Brundtland started, it was people, planet, and prosperity. And prosperity was very much based on a human-centric idea of sustainability. And you can criticize that it's human-centric. You know, it should be for all life. But that's what Brundtland was at that time. So people, planet, and prosperity had all the ingredients that we needed. And we made people, planet, and profit out of it, because we had the belief that this has to be picked up by the corporate world, and it has to be somewhat made more feasible for the corporate world. And that's my biggest criticism, it didn't step out of the existing economic system design. It wanted to find a way to muddle in the existing economic system design. And that's really a huge missed opportunity of the sustainability experts, so to say. And the other thing is that, and that is like a translation of the definition of sustainable development that I just offered right from the Brundtland Report, there's the principle of intra and intergenerational equity. Mm-hmm. So really the idea that whatever decision you take as an individual or an organization or a public authority or a government always think about the consequences of on future generations, which is totally non-existing in the sustainability field. And I would even go so far that intergenerational equity also includes going back to the wisdom of earlier generations, especially everything that we now, as a broader term, call indigenous wisdom. And there's so much indigenous wisdom which has just been buried and just very, very, very slowly sees the light of day again, but against all odds of the existing economic system logic. So it is, in that sense, I would say we haven't seen an evolution. We have seen more of a watering down of sustainability, the opposite of what we wanted, I think, actually, as the majority of the people. But we're just like straitjacketed and handcuffed at the same time due to the logic of the existing system, which is a monocapitalistic system and is not just delivering on what we need.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, I went to business school 2004 till 2008, basically. And although there was a sense and an ease in me, maybe necessary, like to some degree, it was like, oh, but there was very much a settled feeling around those years that this is how it is. It works. What we're doing works, you know, both in terms of financial engineering, but also in terms of accounting practices and so forth. And as well as some of them, you know, we read very little of, I would say, proper economics, but the ones that we did read it was like, this is the way that it is. This is a good description of the world. And it felt kind of closed. And so it felt like I was going to step out into a world of incremental improvements or incremental things and so forth. And then 2008 happened and everything felt like the whole thing sort of blew open.
What you're describing is a successful illusion of separation. Mm-hmm. From reality or the world as it is. Mm. So from that perspective, it has been, you know, the curricula at economics education in business schools was just an outpour of that illusion of separation that put economics on top of ecology and societal needs. And as you rightly say, it's a way of engineering, but it's not just how the world functions. And we just put blinders on. From that perspective, yeah, I think that education at that time gave you all the right feelings because it was so structured and it was so logic and it was growth oriented and you could see yourself growing in that. You could specialize, whereas there's a question that you could ask if specialization is so good. It was cuddling us in some way, and then, as you rightly say, then came the logic of 2008, and you know, we just realize ever since and have that sort of grumbling feeling in our stomach that something's not right, and that is where we very, very slowly see that illusion of separation and also find out that the economic system as we know it is actually a killer machine. And that's hard to recognize and hard to accept, and then also to acknowledge that something else is needed. And that is exactly why, that I'm so happy about that upbringing right between the Brundtland Report on the beginning end and the first Rio conference on the other end, where I was just learning and starting to understand the shortcomings of the current economic system. And that has become a journey ever since, and it's an ongoing journey still. We're just not living in reality. We've created an artificial world and think everything needs to adhere to it, whereas the opposite is actually true.
That's a nice segue. I'd love to kind of dig into a bit more the work that you're doing at the R3.0, and then also if you can maybe weave that with how you see the world, like the non that world, so the bridge between the economic and the ecological, and maybe other realities that
yeah, sure. Should be. Happy to do that. I think one of the major differentiators of R3.0 as sort of the work ecosystem that we have, so what's the majority of our work, has really very much benefited from the idea that we, when 2012 RIA Plus 20 document came out, we started our 3.0, the first thing that we did is that we sort of asked ourselves, so what is a regenerative and distributive economy really? And why is nobody defining it? Why is the academic field not active in that? And the problem with most people in this field is that they are world champions in forecasting and absolute laggers in backcasting. So we've decided to take the backcasting route, which means you need to know what is the ideal that you need to backcast from. And that has really been the work that we did in the first 1, 2, 3 years of R3.0. So what is it that we're really striving towards when we say we want a regenerative and distributive economy? And our government leaders had articulated that they wanted to have that. And the work that we've done ever since is that we are backcasting from that ideal, so to say, of a regenerative and distributive economy. And that has very often helped us to define areas that needed to change. And we also found out that it's not one or the other area that needs to change. They all need to change, and they need to change simultaneously in order to create a systemic leapfrog towards that ideal of a regenerative and distributive economy. And that brought us to develop what we called our R3.0 work ecosystem. The work ecosystem consists of so-called blueprints. Every blueprint touches one specific area that needs to simultaneously in sync needs to leapfrog towards that ideal with all the others, with all the other areas. So they all need to leapfrog in some way. And the first thing for us was to find out what are these areas. And some of us came from the reporting and sustainability reporting field, like myself, for example. Others came from the IT, others again from the human resources side, others from the economic side. So we started off with a basic set of blueprints. And if I say blueprint, I have to explain that this always means a project of about a year with a group of 30 to 50 global experts. They're all funded projects lasting throughout the year and go through different iterations until we finalize what we call a blueprint. So the blueprint is the outcome document of that project. And it's always based or built up in a way that we say, okay, so what's the ideal that we're striving towards? What's the shortcoming in the area that we're discussing in that blueprint today? What are pathways or maturation pathways forward? And what recommendations can we give how to get there? That's sort of the standard buildup of a blueprint. And when we first thought about, so what are these areas that need to change or transform? You actually have to say change is probably not enough. We thought, well, definitely it is reporting, because we saw shortcomings in sustainability reporting that exist, that still exist, and it has even become worse. We may want to touch base on that a little bit later. Then, of course, it needs accounting in a way that fits the needs of the reporting that's necessary. And then, of course, you need data for that. And again, the micro-macro thinking or learning that I had came up again. It is data that we need not just from the corporate side, but also from the regional or an economic system perspective, so that we have sort of guidance around the boundaries of where are we working towards, what are we working towards, and how are we doing. That is very much also the reason for the sustainability context principle in the GRI guidelines, actually. And then we thought, you know, if we had that information and accounting and reporting would work, what would that mean for the development of business models? not just existing business models, but also future business models. And that was very interesting to look at because you needed to look at it from the perspective of the existing economic system, but also the ideation of a regenerative and distributive system. So how can you bridge from the old to the new without definitely going under? Because that is, I think, or what I fear, a lot of businesses will face in the next decade. But they're not prepared for that bridging towards a different idea of a regenerative and distributive economy. So when we had released those four blueprints, there was often the question, so how am I going to implement that in my organization? And true, you know, a really valid question. So we decided to develop a fifth blueprint, which we call the Transformation Journey Blueprint, which really tried to develop a step-by-step process for organizations to embed that thinking in their strategic approaches. So, as you know, from vision to mission, to strategy to processes to products and so on. Also started what we call Transformation Journey Programs. So we also wanted to teach people on that. And up to today, 2023, we've done 8 of these Transformation Journey Programs. And we're just embarking on another one next year in 2024. Mm. And after we finished those 5 blueprints, and through the discussions of the Transformation Journey Programs, we discovered that there are a couple of areas that need more deepening. And that is what we then did in the last couple of years, 4 more blueprints. One is what we call the Sustainable Finance Blueprint. This is really asking the question based on where we are today in this sort of reduced version of sustainability. Does sustainable finance really exist? Yeah, we have a lot of words, a lot of fluffy buzzwords around it, and we have sustainability benchmarks and ratings and rankings. And you ask yourself, in how far does a sustainability report and then the rankings and ratings answer the question about how sustainable an organization really is and how sustainable is it in comparison to other organizations? That's what the ranking.
And then more in that sort of original definition of the sustainability.
And that, in the original definition, really embracing the idea of sustainability context, which, you know, is an area of discussion in itself, because that is one of the major failings or shortcomings still today, that we don't really know how sustainable we are because we miss the sustainability context. So in short, you can say, if I'd like to sum that up a little bit, you know, the situation that we're in at this moment is that companies are only able to tell us how they became less degenerative or maybe less bad, if you want to say it in more colloquial terms. And then what the ratings and rankings and benchmarks do is that they define who's best in class of those who say that they became less bad. None of this, the reports and the benchmarks, say anything about the level of sustainability. But they're using the word. And then, you know, financial products and funds and bonds and everything is based upon that misty, unresolved field of what is a sustainable performance. So sustainable finance, in our perspective, what we concluded was just simply saying, as long as we live in this economic system where everything, every growth is actually built on debt, sustainable finance just simply does not exist. And whatever people call it, it is just simply not true. And then we also embarked on the question, in a regenerative and distributive economy, what is of value? Yeah, what do you call value? And then what do you call then success? And we connected that with the question, or one of the sort of major buzzes that we saw a couple of years ago, that everything needed to become circular. Mm-hmm. You know, the circular economy came up, and even the Netherlands, where I live, that still say that they want to become fully circular by 2035, I think it is. And we just simply thought that's complete nonsense. You just can't say that, because when you look at what a regenerative and distributive economy is, yes, circular is surely a part of what's necessary, but it's not the end goal. So defining an end goal for becoming fully circular, A, will not happen, B, is nonsensical, and three, just doesn't fit with the definition of sustainability. Yeah. So that just needed to be clarified. And that's what we did in what we call value cycles blueprint. And then finally, the last two blueprints that we developed was on educational transformation, because we also very clearly saw that whatever is taught and wherever it's taught, it is not giving people the skills that they need to prepare them for the disruptions that are going to happen. And the last one that we did was what we call funding governance for systemic transformation, just simply because of the fact that whatever needs to transform is generally not funded. Mm-hmm. Just simply because it doesn't fit with the current economic system, because it asks for a change of the system. And even the philanthropic sector has become sort of like totally dependent on the existence of the system and the existence of the problem, because they wouldn't exist if the problem wasn't there. And if you just look at an economic system and when it can be successful, you just need to simply state there's just one economic system that is successful, and that is one that doesn't have external effects. And, you know, we have like 40 to 50 trillion of externalized effects on a yearly basis. That, you know, so whatever people think that they can either muddle through in the existing economic system, that they can avoid the collapse of an economic system, we'll just need to think again, because we are too far down the road. I've said a couple of times, we're already over the cliff. We're in free fall. And the only thing that we see is the fight for those with the biggest parachutes. That's how I would describe the situation right now where we are. And for us at R3.0, it has consequences, because we've not only been or have become, just by all the data that we see, have become collapse aware, but also collapse acknowledging. So what we are striving towards in the future is not to put lipstick on a pig by saying, oh, through everything we do, we want to avoid collapse. I think it's too late for that. But the only thing that we can do is that we focus on what we call post-collapse readiness. So really focusing our energy on what is needed in whatever remains. The situation that we see ourselves in, and you asked me for my interpretation of where we are, well, you know, I just need to open the newspaper here and I look at it from a collapse lens, and I see collapse all around. You know, it's everywhere. If it is the melting down of social systems, if it is the continuous right-wing movement in many countries, which is just an effect of cocooning and the sort of like me first and keeping my stuff and don't take anything away from me, that then leads to like cries for reduction of freedom. Well, you know, it's totally ridiculous, because, you know, I think there is enough freedom if we are in a balanced economic system design. But this economic system design, which has been a race to the top with the idea of trickle-down economics, that from the outset, those in the sustainability field said it's never going to work. They've just been proven right. So in that sense, we are at actually a culmination point of all the different parts of what people schmoozily call the poly crisis. It's hard, rough, brutal collapse. We're seeing just the end phase of that. And don't be mistaken, we're in collapse since the late 70s, or even since the 70s. If you just look at the Limits to Growth report by the Club of Rome and read it today, you know, they have been ridiculed, they have been laughed at, but just look at the curves. And what you see is that they have been highly accurate in what they projected. And it just simply tells us, we haven't acted for 40 years. We had 40 years of time to react, but we just didn't do it. And now we pay the price for that.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting how, I mean, I see the same things. So I will, that's part of why I'm doing this and why I'm curious about what more regenerative stances are, or what the bridges are that are into that, that can lead us into the fog.
Yeah, and I may want to add just one thing. If I talk about collapse, I'm not talking about an apocalypse. I am talking about the collapse of the existing economic system.
Yeah,
and in consequence, it means that the lifestyles and the design of life, or the stereotypes about life that we carried for a long time, will no longer persist. And that means that we will need to learn what a regenerative and distributive economy then really means in detail, and how we can change our lives according to that. And that is actually what post-collapse readiness to a certain degree also means, to help people bridge over to that new sort of life and forget the life as we knew it, because that has a footprint with everything you do. And that cannot longer exist in an unbalanced way, because then it would really mean the end of humanity. And, you know, it's not, I would say it's, we can avoid that, but I'm not saying that we're brave enough or clever enough to really do that. We'll see. The next, I think, 10 to 15, maybe 20 years of our human existence will be decisive about that. And either we'll manage, or, you know, we've been a nice experiment in the evolution.
There is one of the questions, because you mentioned externalities or, mm-hmm. or sort of external effects of our actions. And there is, as I'm growing more, more literate in terms of systems and systems theory, I'm very much pulled towards things that are more open systems related, which means, you know, that then there's a real question around boundary drawing and how we draw, how we view boundaries and how we draw them. Not that there aren't any, but still sort of really questioning those boundaries. And then related to the question of externalities, you know, if nothing's external, then there aren't any externalities necessarily. But there's still that question of that you started with reporting, accounting, measurement, our tools for seeing or interacting with the world. I can't formulate a question around it, but I would love to hear you kind of think about it.
Well, first of all, I think what we need to acknowledge is the fact that the word externalization is already somewhat misleading, because it gives you the impression that you could actually externalize. The Earth as we know it is a closed system. So we cannot externalize anything out of this system. The only thing that we can externalize is into the future. And that is just exactly what the Brundtland Report and the definition of sustainable development says. Don't do that, because you're taking away the opportunity for your kids to have the same sort of opportunities that you had in your own generation. And a lot of the translation of that idea of intergenerational equity is really very much based around that sustainability context principle that we first introduced in GRI G2 in 2002, and then again in GRI G3 in 2006. Those were the two editions where I was responsible for the principles work streams, and where we very clearly said every organization that reports needs to report their performance against what was then called limits and demands. And we have better terms now. We call that thresholds and allocations. So whatever you do, you need to prove that you're staying within your carrying capacities, to use William Catton's words, who actually invented the word overshoot and undershoot. So that's not Kate Raworth, you know, where we just visualized the ideas of overshoot and undershoot, the donut, and then based her donut economics on that. That question of what is success, also the question that we answered in the Value Cycles Blueprint, is very much dependent on the availability of thresholds and allocations information. So a threshold, in colloquial terms, is just simply the question, how big is the cake? How much of whatever resource do we still have in order to use it in just fair, proportionate terms so that we are within our carrying capacities? And the allocation is just simply the translation of that question into an organizational perspective, or maybe even a personal perspective. How much of that cake is for me? And that defines a budget. Like, for example, companies have a carbon budget. And that's one of the areas where that logic already exists. And you just need to prove that you're staying within your carbon budget with whatever you do. Your business model is only sustainable if over the whole life cycle, on scope 1, 2, and 3, you're staying within the carrying capacities of your carbon budget. And that is something that is just a general requirement for all performances. And if you just look at what we have right now in what is called ESG, and you look at a sustainability indicator with a numerator and a denominator, the numerator is your actual performance, and the denominator is your allocation, which is based on a threshold. What companies report is just the numerator. They report their performance, and because they lack the denominator information, they compare their performance to the performance from a year ago, or from the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 5 years averages, maybe an industry average. So from that perspective, we don't really have a true measure of success. And that is one of those things that we've been working on as R3.0. We actually worked with the United Nations Research Institute for Social Development, and we developed indicators that have these denominators. We call them the UNSDPI, UN Sustainable Development Performance Indicators. And we did that because none of the existing sustainability reporting standards offer those. They actually deny that they have the duty to do so, which is totally ridiculous. It's totally nonsensical. But at least they should have developed guidance around that. How do I compare my performance against allocations based on thresholds? And I remember from the times in 2002 and 2006 when we set up the sustainability context principle and wrote it up, there was always a fight about, yeah, but we don't have the data for that. And that was true. But my argument at that time always was, if you take the sustainability context principle away from the rest of the principles and the guidelines, is it still a sustainability reporting standard or guideline? And the answer is no. So you couldn't even use that as an argument that you're still a sustainability reporting guidance or guidelines or now standards. Because this is the only point where the GRI guidelines, now standards, would actually connect to the principles of sustainability, the micro-macro link, your micro-performance against the requirements of a macro situation, aka allocations. So that is one of the things that in a post-collapse readiness world will still be needed. Yeah, we still need to know how we're doing. And this is the only way, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know of any other way, how you can measure that. And the fact that the standards are denying their responsibility for that is just a historical misstep.
Yeah. But what you're, if I understand you correctly, then when we talk about sustainability context, that is sort of the link to the ecosystem or to the bioregion or to the whatever it is that's underlying what you're doing, be it energy or resources or raw materials or
Yeah, you bring up a very important term, bioregion. And that is really also something that we've been thinking about a long time. You know, if you think about, okay, if this system doesn't work in its nation boundaries or in the way that it's structured, nations, and has all these multilateral institutions and all of that, if that doesn't work, what's the sort of unit of measurement that you would actually need to design in a regenerative and distributive economy? And we've come to the point where we said it's not a nation state, it's a bioregion. And a bioregion is defined by normally a watershed. A watershed is the source and the flow, the stock and the flow of water in a given region. Without that water, nothing would be alive. And even though there are questions like climate and biodiversity that are very important, the bioregional definition is really very much based around the existence of a watershed and the flow of water within the watershed. So we've come to grips to the point where we said, this is really how we have to look at the world in the future. And if you divide our wonderful planet into bioregions, you come up with around about 200 different bioregions. It's actually quite the same like the number of nation states. Mm-hmm. But but it's just a different setup and a completely different way of looking at things. Nature defines the boundaries of a bioregion, not a violent or political process or negotiation, because none of this is negotiable. You can't negotiate that in the end, because this is what nature defines for us. And we have no reason to think that, you know, we have negotiation power on that. So if you take that as the basic unit of measurement, you again will need to find out and need to know, okay, what is it that this bioregion can do with what it has? You know, there are many geological different setups of bioregions. So not every bioregion can do everything. It will be very selective. Certain bioregions can do other things better than other bioregions. So the question comes up, what is it that the people that live in that bioregion can actually do with the resources that they have within the carrying capacities? That's why they need thresholds and allocations still in the future. And then really find out also what they cannot do within the carrying capacities that they have. And that defines the portfolio of assets that a bioregion has. The question then comes up is there anything essential that we need that we cannot produce in our bioregion? Mm-hmm. And then the question comes up, okay, where is the nearest bioregion that can potentially do that for us? And the point here really is that already starts to define sort of principles in a bioregional economy. And that is, you don't go to the other part of the planet with big ships, with a huge ecological footprint, in order to get stuff very cheap and under conditions that you do not control. So from that perspective, it's an ethical way of thinking about trade. Where is the nearest bioregion that I can get that essential asset that we can't have? And what we can do, or what do we have in abundance that others might want to have in the nearest bioregion? So that logistical aspect of where's the nearest point of delivery or sale or whatever you want to call it, is an ethical outpouring of living within your means, and is based on that idea of multi-capitalism, which is opposing to monocapitalism. So there's a lot of discussion about growth and the term degrowth and all of that. We're just agnostic to that. We're just saying we're looking at it from the perspective of multiple capitals that we can deal with. And financial capital is just one of those. And we always say, in order to be sustainable, you can't build financial capital on the back of other capitals. Or it means to exploit or over-exploit other capitals, like human resources or natural or nature resources. That whole idea of thresholds and allocations comes from that multi-capital perspective as well. So what we actually need in success measurement is a multi-capital context-based, thresholds and allocations-based way of measuring success. And then another question that then comes up is, what sort of currencies are we going to need in that new setup? And can these currencies reflect scarcity on the one hand and abundance on the other hand? And how would be the interrelations between bioregions on that currency, level? And last but not least, the whole idea of how are we going to govern this set of 200 bioregions and the principles that we need. There's a term that came up in the last couple of years, which is called weaving. So it's really the weaving between bioregions, and also what are the discussion processes, which are the decision-making processes, how are citizens involved in that? It's just so different than what politics is today. Totally dependent on sort of the lobbyist communities, sometimes even dependent on industries and corporations. You see that now in the oil and gas industry. The outcome of COP, for example, is just an outpour of that dependency. You're like a slave to certain industries. All of that would disappear. And also these multilateral organizations like the World Bank, the IMF, the WEF, for example, World Economic Forum, they are just sunsetting in my perspective. I think that the majority of all of these designs will not survive this decade. And the more that the current system does not function, and COP is the best possible example for that, or the failure of the sustainability standards to deal with carrying capacities in the way they should, or whatever political process is happening on whatever directive is coming out. These are just, all of these failures are just accelerating the speed of collapse, the free fall that we're in. And from that perspective, being collapse acknowledging and working on post-collapse readiness, I have my peace with that. It will be harsh. It will even be brutal to some people in all parts of the world. It will have very disruptive effects in the time that we move from one to the other. I'm not making any guesses how many lives we will lose, but it's going to be considerable, I think. And whatever remains just needs to reconnect around what is actually really necessary. And that has always been sort of the mantra of our 3.0, that we only concentrate on what is necessary and that we're not dealing with what is either politically opportune or just simply possible. Because that is what the corporate world focuses on. And they will fight everything that is necessary just for the short-term gain and buck.
There's something that's bubbling in me that's not yet very clear. So I'm going I will attempt to make my confusion visible, and then we'll see what you make of it. There's something around, you mentioned that when we talk about trade, let's say, or some sort of exchange in a bioregional world, then we would be focusing on the essentials. And like one of those things that I've seen as I've been looking at sort of the human predicament of the past, almost decade now, getting to that point. I find that a lot of the things that I thought were sort of human, these were absolutely necessary human needs. A lot of that kind of falls under the culture. Like basically they're like cultural one way or another needs or constraints or something that I've been told or storied into. I mean, these are needs that I've created out of tradition or out of something. They're not necessarily what I would call essential, and letting go of a lot of those essential things that I have from my growing up or whatever has given me more freedom and more flexibility, more joy. So this is like one thread. And then there's like this other word. You talked about the multiple capitals, and then the multiple capitals in one way or another, it sounds like, or in my, what I'm thinking is like that it sounds like that what we would have to introduce is some sort of balance. Balance is also a tricky word, but some sort of dynamic balance of constantly rebalancing, like more like the autopoietic type of balance rather than a static balance. So it kind of, and the scarcity and abundance, that's also sort of depending. It's dependent. All of these are dependent variables, if you will. And then there's the other concept that I really enjoyed in your values and cycles blueprint was this kind of notion that the fungibility between different currencies is not, we have to really think about how we can translate and switch between these different capitals. Like what, you cannot denominate everything in financial currency. You cannot denominate everything in another currency. Like there are going to be different ones that we're going to have to relate to. And in some way, there's going to have to be some sort of exchange rate or some sort of possibility to exchange, but only to certain limits. And that's where your sort of thresholds and allocations come in again. So like these are sort of separate threads that are alive for me. But what comes down to, it's still, where I'm struggling is that there is still this sort of split between the units and their boundaries. Because I mean, also the bioregional boundaries, that it sounds clean, that the boundaries are clear, but there is all of these types of exchange and flows and things that are going on, where the map will be a little bit different, or like it will shift, or like the boundary will be fudgy. It's not like this straight line that you can put down and then you know, but rather it's like it's something else. It's like it's fuzzier than that. It's maybe more like a membrane or something like that. And then I'm wondering about sort of the measurement is one thing, because it's like, okay, so we have to measure the things in the units, but also, we also have to measure the things between the units, and like how big should the between be, or something like that, or like what happens with the stuff that falls between. So and that comes into the relational aspects and the flow aspects and those things. And so there's something here that I'm struggling with. On one end, I'm like, yes, this sounds great. And on the other end, I'm like, I see all these like hardly defined challenges that seem to point to a different way of seeing the world, where,
the World Climate Index was, or the state of the climate report was mentioning, we're entering uncharted territory. Mm. And that's really what it is. And within that, there are certain hard facts that is not negotiable, and nature will define what it is. So, for example, you could have said that 1.5 degrees is not a target. It is a limit. Mm-hmm. But we make it targets, and we make it as if we could negotiate. But with whom are we negotiating? Just negotiating how much failure all of us can actually allow themselves. And then, by the way, we're heading towards a 2.5 degree world, and how bad that is, and we can all mourn that, but we could have made other decisions in the last 40 years. So there are certain things that, you know, I just need to take as hard facts. And on top of that comes everything that we as humans make out of it, in the way how we construct lives, and in the way how we exchange or have cultural differences in different parts of the world. And that will continue. But I would just simply think that, for example, way more indigenous wisdom from the past will be revitalized in different parts of the world, in different bioregions. And then there is the weaved learning between bioregions. That is a highly cultural aspect of really doubting your own principles to a certain degree, and potentially redesigning the way how you understand who you are and how that potentially also changes cultures in different parts of the world. I wished we had way more indigenous wisdom, for example, in Europe. There is, of course, a lot of agricultural wisdom and other things, but a lot of the rest is just religion and violence. And there are other parts of the world that have solved that way more adequate in a basic peace with each other and with nature. So that these questions of ownership that we in the Western world so much cling to did not even come up as a topic, that would be a way how you design your being and who you are and what you're worth and all of that. So there is so much cultural aspects still in those different parts of the world that we have to make fit within the boundaries of these hard facts. Mm-hmm. And we can do that. You know, we have the capability to do that. Question is always, do we have the will to do it? Mm-hmm. And then, I just wanted to put your sort of your struggling a little bit into perspective. You know, that there are hard facts and boundaries, and within that, we're very flexible. We use the term membrane, and I think that's a good term for that way to discuss interrelation and even interbeing with nature and different parts of the world and how they adhere to the new system. And then I think there's even a technological aspect. You know, if you look at, for example, the data that we still need for all of that, even in a new economic system and a bioregional setup, there are certain technologies that we will continue to use. The question of social media comes up, and the question of how to control that comes up. And we're just seeing the worst of it right now, you know, with all the hacking and all the fake news and all the influencing from other forces. It's all based on power games and violence. Mm-hmm. Even in between people's connecting or people connecting on social media with bullying and a lot of greed taking and whatever it is. So yeah, I think those are not exclusive of each other. I think they are actually inclusive of each other. But the first thing that you need to come to grips with is very much, what are the hard facts? Mm-hmm. There are certain things we just cannot influence. And there are other things, if we accept and acknowledge that, we can influence a lot. That's where culture comes in. That's where weaving capacity comes in. That's where, you know, new methodologies like sociocracy for all or pro-social come in, where the Eleanor Ostrom's principles of governing the commons come in. All of those things have a place in a bioregional setup as well. It is just that we need to be very clear what the boundaries are, how far we can go, and where there's really a hard stop.
And there it is, sort of, it comes back to that question of, because one thing that I wanted to interject, or like another thing that I'm struggling with, is like when we talk about design, there's a way to understand that word where it actually really works, but there's another way to understand design as a sort of a cognitive process or like it's a thinking process, and there is like there's a trap around there if we're not careful with the use, but we can maybe leave that to the side. What I am really curious about though is sort of that measurement. I mean, I had Indy Johar on the podcast, and he talked about this sort of the boring revolution and sort of the computational accounting, and like when we can increase the resolution, then we can start seeing all of these new flows of value exchange or exchange in general, and that will shift how we're thinking. But at the same time, there's like, I heard someone speak to provocatively and semi-jokingly, but still there's a point to that, like said that the climate crisis, the temperature increase that we are seeing in the world, it's actually a result of the Celsius scale. Like if we didn't have the Celsius measurement, we wouldn't have the climate crisis. There would be a lot of other stuff going on. The collapse that you were pointing to that we're seeing, that we could be seeing all around us. But instead of it being called a climate crisis or some crisis over there or somewhere else, you know, I would actually might be able to see or pay attention to the collapse of the relationships and the collapse of the institutions and the collapse of the things that are like happening around me. Like you heard Tyson Yunkaport speak of how he looks at the termite mounds in Australia, and that to them, that's a clear signal that the ecosystem is really distressed. Like it hasn't looked like that for a long time. So there is a way also that these measurements hide, which is, you know, a theme that's running through your career as well, that the measurements are, they reveal and they hide something, and there's like an occlusion that happens. So, you know, I'm fighting with myself sometimes around the measure more, measure less, measure more accurate, and then what does accurate mean? Because it's always a boundary drawing and a delimitation, and something's left out.
Well, from my perspective, I of course look at my career and how it evolved over time, and it was always the idea and the sort of old saying of Brunt Eyes that said, sunlight is the best disinfectant. Mm-hmm. So measurement always is a value in itself for me. And then, of course, I worked in a corporate for a decade. I worked in the accounting sector, and they themselves are defining certain worlds. And, of course, my thinking around measurement and success measurement comes from my biased past. And I recognize that there are others who think differently and even way more abundant in ways of seeing things and measure things. And, you know, knowing that indigenous people didn't have measurement at all, they just saw things and knew what the status was. They didn't need any measurement for that. But, you know, through that sort of illusion of separation that we've been through the last hundreds of years and even more decades, we have totally unlearned to see and then to measure in the way how I've been raised in this field is my first best solution. Because I think that if we don't follow that path, we will never see. Because we have unlearned to see. There are only certain people who have the skills to see. And I would even, you know, if I go into the woods, would I see a dying tree? Yes, I would see that. But would I see early signs of a sick tree? Possibly not. So I am clinging to what my core competency is, and where so far nobody convinced me that there is a better way. It is maybe not the only way, but at least it's a valuable way. And from that perspective, this is what I decided is good for me and good for everybody else in my perspective, and would not exclude that there are not many, many other ways how to, I wouldn't call it measurement, I would simply see it seeing or being. Yeah, also the feeling of something that's not right is some sort of measurement, if you want. And I think from what I have learned over the decades and how important sustainability contexts and thresholds and allocations are, I also started to learn measuring in other ways or be more open and more aware how to see and feel other things. I'm a totally different person than 20 years ago. So from that perspective, I think they are not exclusive of each other. They sort of are sort of developing in a way that one makes you see or feel or be the other. And just looking at the status of people and how they see or feel things, I doubt that they would explore what I explored over the last 10, 20 years without having that information that I had. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to me, again, you know, those are not things that exclude each other. They're all somewhat interlinked. They build on each other. Some have biases. Some have, a different way of measuring from hard facts into soft facts, into cultural aspects, into individual aspects, into the seeing and feeling and being over time. It is, you know, we just need to recognize we have not learned that. So, and for me with 57, I'm happy that I've made a development myself, but every young person still comes out of business school or whatever is incapable of doing it.
And I mean, it's interesting though, because I'm wondering, in a way, I think when you step out into reporting land and you look at measurements and standards and these things, I mean, that might be your ecosystem. That might be your forest. Yeah. And I would, it feels like, when you're speaking, that you will be able to tell if a reporting standard that comes out, you know, without really necessarily going into every detail, I think you will have a pretty good feeling about whether this is kind of holds water or not. Like, is it a good, and so I think that intuition is developed where we spend our time. And then, you know, if we don't spend our time in the forest, then it's hard for us to.
I think I have a quite good bullshit barometer.
Yeah, exactly.
And that just developed over time. There are certain words that I look for. There are certain patterns of communication that I look for. If I open a sustainability report, I would know within 5 minutes what it is. I don't need to read 300 pages. I would know after 5 minutes.
I think I'm really curious about one thing that you said now, because you said that you're not the same person that you were 20 years ago, which is, you know, that's reassuring to hear. But I'm wondering if there is this level of curiosity and this can you speak to anything in terms of what has enabled you to take the steps that you've taken, or like to move in this direction that it's like this simple question, and I mean it respectfully, is like, why do you care?
Well, you know, I think one of the main motivators is always when you have kids. I now even have a grandkid. My voice is deteriorating a bit. So that has a huge motivational effect. Always had from the very beginning. And I think it's also these triggers that you have at a certain point in your life. For me, reading the Brundtland report has been a real revelation. And while I'm not okay with everything that's in the Brundtland report, I still think it's more important than the Bible for me. And I've always went back and saw how do I adhere to the deeper meaning of the Brundtland report. And it enables you, whenever you go on that journey, it enables you to see the shortcomings of what is existing. You're just triggered. And, you know, that makes you angry. And you really wanna change things. You know, we're all humans that want a better life for everybody or for all life. Then it's also, I think, simply the joy of nature that has a huge effect, or had an even growing effect on me. I'm recognizing the beauty of nature much more than I did in my teens. It was just there. Yeah, nice. But now I really very deeply appreciate the joy and the beauty of nature much more than I did in the past. And it also let me do things that I hadn't expected that I would do. So, for example, everything here in our household that can be changed to be more sustainable, the really practical things, and seeing how it works while others are telling us, oh, no, you know, all your fruit and vegetable need to be packed in plastic, you know, for bacteria and health reasons. No. No, not necessary. Yeah. Mm. Or how to make your own household energy positive, or how to grow your own food to a certain degree, as much as you have the privilege to have space to do that. Or, you know, just to completely redesigning our front garden to be a bee paradise. Mm. So, and whenever I go out with the dog and I hear it like the whole time, that makes me a happy person. It's these very little things where you really realize I contributed. I did something for the health of others. And it didn't cost anything, you know, just seeding those flowers, you know, come on, a couple of euros. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. now I benefit from that, like, for the rest of the year. And now even in my backyard, where we're growing own food, those same bees from the foreground or from the front garden come to the back garden and pollinate. And there were years where that was not happening. So we needed to walk around and needed to pollinate ourselves. The bees are back. So they do. They say thank you to me by pollinating in the back of the house. So it's just these little things that really motivate. And then also the development of community. You know, I would be honestly a cynic asshole if I hadn't had that development of community around me. And if I just look at how R3.0 developed from a couple of dozen people to a community of about 25,000 people around the world, and really everywhere around the world, it brings so much joy, so much fun, but also so much challenge around my own biased thinking. That is what enlightens me and what enriches me, and that no corporate context could ever give me. So I have to say, since I started R3.0 2012, it has really enriched my life and has made me a better person and a way more balanced person overall. So, and that's what I'm realizing, that is a huge gift that I carry very much in my heart and what I want to continue for the rest of my life, at least my work life. But that's the next thing. Mm-hmm. When you're in a situation like me, you never think about an end of your work life. You will potentially always work. Less, of course, but there's so much excitement and so much willingness to contribute that might potentially never end until I just fall down.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this conversation. I really, really appreciated it and appreciate it. What are the resources that you would point people towards for finding you?
Well, of course, we have a website, www.r3-0.org. That's our repository of all of the blueprints, which are global public goods. You can download them free of charge. They are available to everybody in the world. We have white papers, we have opinion papers, case study, and something that we call common good resources as well. We have training offers, we have a yearly conference, we have a Medium channel where we have posted, I think, about 120 articles so far, though there's more than enough to find R3.0. And those who want to find me personally, I'm doing quite some stuff on LinkedIn. I have a newsletter which is called The Lighthouse Keeper, which had seen 22 editions so far. I do that like every 2 months, so spoil people with messages like every day. And then what I also do is what is called a Sunday thought. And that is just one single thought, something that came up during the week and where I thought it might be interesting to just share my view on that. And honestly speaking, I had never expected that. That seems to be the most successful of all of my sort of voicings. I now see like 70 to 100,000 views on some of those Sunday thoughts. I never expected that because I always thought, well, people should be off on Sunday. But many people really use the Sunday to also think. And I get a lot of response to that and also a lot of private messages, really overwhelming because I offer a thought and then I open my LinkedIn account on Monday morning and I have like 200 private messages and 100 of them asking me for 30 minutes of my time. And it's just not doable. But I do see that there is value of these thoughts for some people. So those are ways to find me and R3.0.
Wonderful. Yeah, the links will be also in the show notes for this. And thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate this conversation and to have spent this time with you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me.